Exodus chapter 34. But I wonder, perhaps someone might ask you later what it was all about this evening. And you'll say, well, it was about a girl who went out on the razzle and she met the local celebrity influencer. And things got out of control. And he took advantage of her. Actually, it rather looks like he raped her. And then her brothers were furious about this, and they hatched this plan of revenge, and they ended up slaughtering not just the rapist, but his dad as well, and a whole city full of innocent, defenseless men. And then after they'd done this, they did some looting and plundering, and they kidnapped all of the children from the city and all of the women, and then they went home and they had a bust-up with their dad. And the person that you're talking to could be forgiven for saying, but I thought you said you went to church. I didn't realise you went to the movies. And it was obviously a Quentin Tarantino film. And you say, well, no, actually, this was a story that was told by Moses. And it wasn't based on a true story. It actually was a true story. And they ask, well, what was the moral in the story? Was there a hero who turned up at the end, like John Wick, or The Equalizer, and who sorted out all the villains? And you have to say, oh, I'm afraid there wasn't. The chapter just finished with them all having an argument. And we might ask, what is this chapter doing in the Bible? It's an horrendous chapter. Well, yes, it is. And here, portrayed to us, is the havoc and the evil that sin has unleashed into this world. The Bible will always give you the unredacted, uncensored horror of what sin has done. It'll give you warnings. I mean, you could take out some sort of moral warnings from chapter 34 if you so wish, and I think we'll do that. But also, the Bible will give you the most incredible encouragement as well. We find real encouragement here. You think, in chapter 34... Well, I think there is an encouragement. My Bible divides the text up into days of the year, so that it takes you through the Old Testament once, and then the Psalms twice, and the New Testament twice. So I have a date by Genesis chapter 34 of January the 19th, and that happens, I looked it up, to be a Sunday, the next one in 2025. So my morning devotion before I come here and preach on the 19th of January is going to be the rape of Dinah and the massacre of Shechem by Levi and Simeon. You think, is that going to inspire me to come to church and to worship? Well, absolutely it is. Do you want to know why? It's for this reason, because there is a Genesis chapter 35 after the horror of Genesis 34. Okay, Genesis 34 is a godless chapter. It's godless in the activity that takes place. It's godless in the fact that God doesn't appear in it or speak in it at all. But after all of that carnage and mess that the Old Testament church has made in chapter 34, God has not walked away. That's what stuns me. He hasn't washed his hands of his people. He most certainly doesn't condone what they've done, but he will not break his covenant, and there is still a church in chapter 35. And that's why I'll come to worship on January the 19th, God willing, if I'm still here. And I'll remember, I hope, that at the end of this service I chose Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound. Because that's, I think, where this chapter leads us to. Sin abounds in chapter 34. It really does. But God's grace superabounds, even in the face of that. So let's come to the text. And first of all, I want you to see the problem. The root of the problem is found at the end of the previous chapter, in verses 17 to 20. And we read there, "But Jacob journeyed to Succoth, and built himself a house, and made booths for his livestock. Therefore the name of the place is called Succoth. And Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram. And he camped before the city, and from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father, he brought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he pitched his tent. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Jacob is on a journey. He's on his way, it says. He's still on his way. He's still on the journey from Paddan Aram. It's been a long journey, a 20-year journey. He'd fled, first of all, from the fury of his brother Esau. He'd left home. He left his family. But right at the beginning of the journey, as he set off on that journey at a place called Bethel, he had met God, or rather God had met him. And he blessed him, and he promised to be with him and to bring him back one day. Jacob had then spent 2 decades, 20 years, in exile, in a hard time. He had to put up with his tricky, duplicitous uncle Laban. He then had a complicated domestic arrangements with 4 wives and, by this stage, 11 sons and at least 1 daughter. He had the nigh-on-impossible working conditions that Laban put on him. He kept changing his contract all the time. But God had been with him every step of the way. And at the end of those 20 years, God said, it's time to go home. You can come home now. It had been a perilous return leg, in which he'd been delivered 3 times. Once God the Intimidator, had turned up and put the frighteners on Laban, who was chasing him down. The second deliverance was probably the most significant of all. God delivered Jacob from God himself. He saw his face at Peniel, where he wrestled with God, and yet his life was spared. And then he's delivered from Esau, who rides out to meet him with 400 men, but not to kill him, but to kiss him and welcome him home. And Jacob does so well at this point of the journey. When Esau invites him to come and live with him in the land of Edom, Jacob refuses that. He does it in a Jacob-like way, because he's Jacob, isn't it? He makes his excuses. He's a little bit vague about what he's going to do, but he's right not to go to Edom. God has called him to come home, to Canaan. But there's a destination in Canaan, there's an end to the journey, and it's to come back to where it all began, to Bethel. I think that is implicit in chapter 35, verse 1. Arise and go to Bethel, God says. But now, when Jacob gets to Shechem, he is within spitting distance of Bethel, the end of the journey. 1 more day would have got him there. He's 20 miles away, but he stops at Shechem. He falls 1 day short, and the pilgrim suddenly becomes a settler. Well, Shechem's a nice place. It's good for livestock, plenty of room. The locals are okay. It seems you can do business with them. And Jacob ends up buying land and building a house. And our alarm bells ought to be ringing, I think, here. For 19 years, 364 days, Jacob has been on a journey with God. And he stops 1 day short of where he's supposed to be. He nearly obeys the call of God. And then he stops. And a day becomes a year. And then it becomes at least a decade, I think. I said that gap is quite a big period of time between chapter 33 and 34. When Dinah, this little girl, arrives at Shechem, first of all, she would have probably been a toddler. Now she's all grown up. Simeon and Levi would have probably been 9, 10, 11 maybe at most. And by this stage, they are grown-up men capable of massacring a whole city. And the man who's been called to live by faith as a sojourner, as a pilgrim in the land that God would give to him, to walk in it with God, and camp in it with God, to be the one who owned everything and yet possessed nothing, has stopped being a pilgrim. And he stopped his journey with God and become the settler in Shechem. He's so close to where God had called him, and yet, so far, I'm actually trusting and obeying.
You think about it, none of the horror of chapter 34 would have happened if Jacob had listened and finished his journey. They wouldn't have been at Shechem. Derek Kidner says, by halting his own pilgrimage, Jacob was endangering those more vulnerable than himself. And I think that's true. We'll see that in the case of Dinah. But secondly, we've got a peril here, a real danger. I don't know if you got the greatest danger that's rising in chapter 34. A danger. Okay. Very good. That's a good question to ask. I tend to make all the points start with the first letter, so good thing to say, because sometimes it's better to use a more obvious word. So there's a danger in this chapter. You've messed up my alliteration there. I don't know if you noticed what the danger was that's rising in chapter 34. There's a real satanic plot which is being hatched here. It's you'll have to stop now, because there's about 100 other people behind you. You ask me afterwards, okay? Because if you look behind you, there's a lot of other people who do want to hear the sermon as well. Okay. If it gets too much, you can sit at the back and have a cup of tea and a biscuit if you want. That's absolutely really welcome to be here. It's lovely to have you here. Okay, but please let me carry on. Okay, so the danger, the peril in this chapter, did you notice what it is? I think you see it in three words spoken twice. In verse 16, it's become one people. And then verse 22, it's become one people. It's what Hamor is offering in verse 9, to make marriages with us, to give your daughters to us, and take your daughters, our daughters, for yourselves, and you shall dwell with us. It's the outcome which is laid out by Hamor to his people in verse 23. Everything is going to become ours. Because if they're going to become one people, then the one people will not be God's people. It will be the people of Canaan. And the story of the Bible from Genesis 3 onwards is that there are going to be two people, two families in this world. God is going to have his family, whom he'll save out of the world by his wonderful grace, and there'll be a history-long enmity between the church and the world. The church will fight to see the world saved, come to faith in the King. It's what we want, it's what we long for, what we pray for, and the world will fight to see the church silenced and swallowed up. And God's plan is to grow and to keep his people, even while they're in the midst of the world, that they might be a light to the world. Can you see that that's the danger in this chapter? It's not Shechem's hormones or Levi and Simeon's testosterone and their fury. It's actually this danger of them being assimilated and swallowed up and becoming one people. And I think one of the greatest miracles of all time is that God is able to keep his people as a people. I was thinking, even in the 400 years that Israel are in exile in Egypt, at the end of that period, you know where Israel is and where Egypt is, don't you? They are still separate people. God has maintained his people. They've not become assimilated into Egypt. I can remember saying when we preached at the beginning of Exodus that about 400 years ago, lots and lots of Huguenots left France and came to this country. They were being persecuted. They were Protestants in France. And the Catholic Church turned against them, first of all on St. Bartholomew's Day, 1572. Thousands were massacred. Many fled to England. And then when the Edict of Nantes was revoked by Louis XIV in the next century, and probably, I don't know, 100,000 French Protestants fled to England. And they settled in Spitalfield in London. and they spoke French. They were still French. They built French-speaking churches. They had French customs. And yet, where are the Huguenots today, 400 years later? They've simply been assimilated into the United Kingdom culture. They've become English, British. You see their names still. Boson K. Do you remember Reggie Boson K? Reading the news? That's a Huguenot name. Coulthard. David Coulthard, the Formula One driver. That's a Huguenot name. Farage. As in Nigel. He's an immigrant from France. Well, he comes from immigrant stock. Oliver. Yeah, that's a Huguenot name. But I'm not French. I failed my French O level. I haven't got French culture within me. We've simply been swallowed up into English culture. And yet God keeps his church distinct. That's what he has to do. And yet in this chapter they're saying, let's become one people. Let's become part of the world. And it goes on and on throughout scripture. God says at the beginning there'll be two families. Balaam comes up with that plot of seduction. You marry into their families. You won't have to attack them. You'll just swallow them up. Nebuchadnezzar, through compulsion, tries to get Jews to become Babylonians, everybody to become Babylonians. Antiochus Epiphanes, or Haman, for example, they're people who try to eradicate the church. And despite all the dangers without, and indeed within, the Old Testament church is always longing to be like the other nations. God simply doesn't let his people go. And you can tell where the world ends and the church begins. As we get to the glory of the New Covenant church, Peter can take all the names and the nouns and the adjectives of the Old Testament and apply them to us today and say, you're a distinct people. You are a chosen race. You're a royal priesthood. You're a holy nation. You're a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. You once were not a people, he said. Now you're the people of God. You once haven't obtained mercy, but now you have obtained mercy. But don't go thinking Satan's given up on his plot to swallow up the church and there be one people again. He tries to blur the lines between the church and the world, whether it's by persecution or by seduction, or by the church becoming an unsalted, lightless, and therefore lifeless extension of the world. And that's what's playing out behind the scenes in Genesis 34. The peril, or the danger, is that people who are at this point in history carrying the covenant for us, and if they drop it, there isn't a covenant to be carried on, they are in danger of dropping it and becoming just part of Canaanite culture. Thirdly, we've got the protagonists. Well, you'd have had a question to say about that, but the leading characters in the story, the players. We've got Dinah. Dinah, look at her. She's being pulled in by Shechem society. I think when we read, Dinah went out to see the women of the land. Let's be realistic about that. She's not out visiting, giving lessons on covenant history to them. She's taking in lessons on Canaanite life. She's off exploring Canaanite nightclubs and Shechem's nightlife. I think that's so true what Derek Kidner said. Jacob was, by stopping his pilgrimage, endangering those more vulnerable than himself. He's exposing his daughter to all of this. And the pull and the attraction and the danger of what Shechem offers is huge. Then there's the man. Shechem himself is a city and is also a man. Hamor's son. He's a man who's culpable. He forces himself on Dinah. But there is, I mean, it's hard to say. There's something, perhaps he's the only person with a spark of hope in this chapter, in that he does love Dinah. A strange way of showing it. I'm not so sure that she completely had rejected his advances, because she's happy to carry on living with him. But He wants to take her as a wife. He wants to look after her. Then there's his father, Hamor. He's the fixer who wants it all neatly tied up with a good arrangement for both sides, although his side will win most. Then there's Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers. They're just deadly, aren't they, in their deception. They have a plan already hatched out. It's to incapacitate the men of Shechem before murdering all of them in cold blood. And then, with their brothers, going in and just looting the place. Going in, stripping the dead, going into the houses, getting all of the plunder, going into the fields, taking it all, and then taking away the children and the women as prisoners. These are the ugly brothers, aren't they? And Jacob would never forget what they did and his dying words to them. He said, "Cursed be their anger and their wrath, for it is cruel." But there's another character, the most important character of all, who, Jacob, comes out of this chapter as such a sad, pathetic, passive figure. He's more interested in keeping the peace than doing what's right. Does he actually care about Dinah, do you think? I don't think he did. We've already seen the favouritism in Jacob's life, that he is fixated on Rachel, his favourite wife, and Joseph, her son. That would destroy the family as you go on down the line. But Dinah was Leah's daughter. We'll see later, he doesn't really care about the other parts of the family. He doesn't take the lead in working things out with Hamor. He doesn't act like a father to this family. The only time when Jacob gets animated or angry is verse 30, when it's all about what you've done to me. "You've brought trouble on me," he says to Levi and Simeon. Not Levi and Simeon, "What on earth have you done?" That's reprehensible. "You brought shame on our God. You brought trouble on me. And you've made me to stink to the inhabitants of the land." That's a tragic irony, isn't it? Because the man through whom God had promised that he would bless all the families on the earth has become a stench to them. And he says, "Now I'll be destroyed, and all my household." Oh, what troubles you've brought on me. Those are the words of Jacob the great appeaser. He just wanted to brush it all under the carpet and let it all go. And those words are met then by the words of the great avengers. They spit back that he treated our sister like a whore. A wrong had been done. But that wrong had been met by two more wrongs. Paralyzed fear, doing nothing on Jacob's part, and unbridled fury on Levi and Simeon's part. And the appeaser and the avengers have only made things worse. And it's a hopeless, total disaster, isn't it, of a chapter? That, if that was all you had of your Bible, you'd think there's nothing to see here, wouldn't you? And yet, fourthly, there's preservation. Chapter 35, verse 1. Isn't it wonderful how this chapter starts? "God said to Jacob." Isn't that exciting? I'd be expecting at the end of chapter 34 for God to say absolutely nothing at all and just turn his back and walk away on these hopeless people. But God said to Jacob, "Arise, go to Bethel, Jacob, and dwell there." That reminds me a little bit of the book of Jonah. Is it you? Where God says to Jonah, "Go to Nineveh, to the great city, preach to that city." And Jonah says, "No way. I'm not going to Nineveh. They're the enemies. They're not going to hear your word, God. I'm going to go to Tarshish," in the opposite direction. He gets on his ship and he sails away to Tarshish. And God sends the storm, first of all. They all work out that it's Jonah's fault. And there's a really simple way of stopping the storm. Do you know what it is? is to for Jonah to say, oh, look, you're going to have to turn the boat round, lads, because I've got to go to Nineveh. Or at least put me on another boat. But that's not what Jonah's going to do. Jonah would rather commit suicide than go and preach in Nineveh. He says, you throw me into the water, that will stop the storm. Now, he's doing that because he would rather die than go to Nineveh. He doesn't know about Jonah and the whale yet, because it hasn't happened yet. And the last thing in the world he was expecting was a great fish to come and swallow him and carry him and then vomit him up on the beach. But then it happens, and we get those wonderful words. And the word of the Lord came to Jonah the second time. And it's go to Nineveh. As I was saying, Jonah, should we do it my way? Or are you going to do it the hard way? And I think we've got something similar here. Look, Jacob, arise. Go to Bethel. Go back to where it all started. Go back and fulfill the vows that you made to me there at the first. I wonder if the only person more surprised than us is Jacob himself. But God hasn't given up. And God responds to his cry. And he responds to God's command. I think, oh, are we seeing repentance here? As he turns from the idols of the land that no doubt had accumulated during a decade in Shechem. In verse 2, he calls for rededication to the Lord for all of his household. And then he says one of the most beautiful lines I've ever read. And I only ever noticed it for the first time on Friday. I must have read it many times before, but I don't think I'll ever forget these words now. It's he prays that I might make an altar to, and these are the words, to the God who answers me in the day of my distress and has been with me wherever I have gone. What sort of God is this who answers again and again and again in the days of his people's even self-inflicted distress? I think those words, I mean, this has been a day of distress, chapter 34, for Jacob. We're not told what he said at the end of chapter 34, but there must have been a point where he'd sat down and he cried out to God and said, I don't know what to do. There isn't any way out of this mess. Everything is ruined. And yet God had said, arise and go to Bethel and build an altar there and finish what you promised to do. Who is this God who's been with me wherever I have gone, even though so often I've gone astray? Who is this God who just won't wash his hands of the sometimes wretched, useless, infuriating people? Well, he's the God of Jacob. He's the only God. The wonderful, merciful, kind, faithful God of covenant love. Why would you ever want idols when this God can be your God and you can belong to him? Despite Jacob's certainty that they're going to be destroyed, they're not. Great words of terror from God fell on the cities that were around them so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. Looks like God the Intimidator was at work again, doesn't it? Striking fear into his foes as his little flock limped their way to Bethel. And he gets to Bethel and he calls on the God of Bethel, the God who appeared to him at the beginning, and the God who he says has been with me all of the way, all of the journey, the God who was still with him at the end. God hasn't given up. That's what I want you to take away from this horrendous chapter. That the church is still plodding on, despite the chaos and the catastrophes that she so often brings on herself, and the covenant is still being carried forwards into the future. But you might say, wait, okay, I can see that, but it isn't fair, is it? Because these people, they just don't deserve it.
well, I know. And it isn't fair. They didn't deserve what God had given to them. But you know, none of us do. And that's why it's called grace. He doesn't give us what we deserve. He's prepared instead to give us his son. But you say, there's an awful lot of things that are still unresolved in chapter 34. What about the outrageous things that they've done? Does God just sweep all of that sin under heaven's carpet? Well, no, God doesn't do that. He's a just God, as well as a merciful, gracious God. And God puts all of that sin, that horrendous, stinking sin, onto the shoulders of his beloved Son. The Son who came neither as an appeaser or an avenger. He didn't come either in fear or in fury, but rather carved the track of burning love in tangles of deceit and lies. He willingly endured a scandal that eclipses the scandal of Genesis 34, when the creatures spat into the Creator's face. We took the Son of God and nailed him to a cursed cross. But even there, God made that cross to be the means through which he would save his people and forgive all of their sins through the atoning blood of the greatest son of Jacob, the Son of God, Jesus. And through that cross, he gathers in that one family, out of Jew and out of Gentile, that will be his family through faith. It's just simply amazing grace. It's all it is that insists that there's a chapter 35 after the horror of chapter 34. It's just amazing grace to save a wretch like Jacob, like me, and like you. If you're willing to come in faith to the Lord Jesus that the Father sent to save us. As a Christian, I do find such encouragement from this passage to press on. It's wonderful to see God's grace in action. In the light of all this sin, God doesn't say, "Oh, I can't fix this. I'm not prepared to carry on with you." It's just been wonderful for me to be reminded that he is the God who answers me in the days of my distress and is with me. And that makes me, like Jacob, want to put away my idols and pick up my pilgrimage and walk with my God to the next day. It's a shame, isn't it, that we haven't got the Lord's Supper this evening, we had it this morning, but that would have been wonderful that he would have called us back, not to Bethel, but to the cross where it all began, and say to us, "Don't you really understand how much I love you?" Because that's what the cross says to us. "Don't you really understand that where all your sin abounded, and if we were to write our sin out, it would look pretty hideous, like chapter 34, I didn't give up on you. My grace through my Son superabounded." And we come back to the cross and to the wonderful, wonderful grace of God that we're allowed to sing about now as we close. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me.